Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of November 9th, 2012. The country voted this past week, as you may be aware, but the president might not have as much effect on your wallet as the folks down ballot.
Voting local is clearly the place that's going to have the biggest impact on your bottom line.
America honors its veterans this week, and their biggest burdens aren't just mental or physical, they're also financial.
It's going to allow me to be able to kind of focus on moving forward, because the main focus right now with my treatment is to move on and to kind of develop the other side of myself.
And in a perfect world, you would only have to pay for the cable channels you actually watch, right?
The problem is that when you do the back of the envelope math, it becomes very clear very quickly. That TV on demand would probably be either much more expensive than we think or much lower quality than we'd accept.
Those stories and oh so much more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
It is finally over. The debates, the ads, the polls. Here's hoping they give us at least a few weeks before talking about campaign 2014. Well, now that Americans know who their leader will be for the next 4 years, the hope is that he and the rest of them will find a way to pull together to deal with the big issues facing the nation. Both the president and the House Majority Leader John Boehner sound like they're willing to work together.
Tonight, you voted for action. Not politics as usual. You elected us to focus on your jobs, not ours. And in the coming weeks and months, I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together. Reducing our deficit, reforming our tax code, fixing our immigration system, freeing ourselves from foreign oil. We've got more work to do.
Mr. President, this is your moment. We're ready to be led, not as Democrats or Republicans, but as Americans. We want you to lead, not as a liberal or conservative, but as President of the United States of America. We want you to succeed. Let's challenge ourselves to find the common ground that has eluded us. Let's rise above the dysfunction and do the right thing together for our country.
Of course, there are plenty of big issues out there that could have an impact on your wallet, and we're going to look at two of them today, healthcare and the fiscal cliff. Our health desk reporter Dan Gorenstein joins us now from WHYY in Philadelphia. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Tess.
And David Gura is in our Washington Bureau. Hello to you.
Hi, Tess.
Dan, let me start with you, and let's just briefly talk about what happens from here on out with Obamacare. What kind of important dates do we have coming up?
Right. So the first date that's important that everybody's watching in healthcare is November 16th. That's the day when states have to decide whether or not they're going to establish these so-called state health exchanges. And, you know, before anybody freaks out about what a state health exchange is, just sort of think about it as like Travelocity, but for health insurance. And so states have to make that decision in the next week.
Wow. So that's coming up right soon here.
Yes, there's a lot of pressure.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about these exchanges, because this is something where you mentioned that states have to decide whether they're going to participate.
That's right. And so what the states have to do, they're going to have to figure out whether or not it's in their interest to participate. And obviously, some politics is going to be involved. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of states that have said, forget it, we're not going to do it. There are a couple ballot initiatives that passed earlier this past week that said, we're not going to join the exchange. And so if that happens, then the federal government is going to establish an exchange that's really going to help consumers become these kind of like insurance shoppers.
Hmm. Well, for those who may be involved in these exchanges, can you just remind us how those are going to work and who's going to be eligible?
You know, most of us are going to continue to get insurance through our workplace. Mm-hmm. But there are about 30 million Americans who are going to get their insurance either through Medicaid or through one of these exchanges. And so basically and you'll get a subsidy, right? People who can't get it through their job or can't afford it, they're going to get some federal help to pay for the cost of health insurance. And they're going to be able to go online and they're going to be able to look and see, okay, what plan is going to meet my needs? And one of the things that's really going to be helpful, I think, for consumers here is that each plan that's part of the exchange is going to have a basic bare minimum package. So it's sort of really part of the idea, at least, and there's no guarantee that this will happen, but part of the goal of the Affordable Care Act is to help demystify health insurance and to make it easier for people to get their arms around what it is and what it means and what they'll get out of it.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another somewhat, actually a completely complicated topic. And David, let me bring you in from Washington there, where I don't know how many times are we going to hear this phrase fiscal cliff over the next 6-7 weeks?
Over
million,
and over again.
Two?
I think they've rebranded it. You have to call it the so-called fiscal cliff.
Okay, well, tell us what the so-called fiscal cliff is.
It's basically a series of tax increases and spending cuts that would kick in at the end of the year. So, you know, long story short, if that were to happen, if all of this stuff were to take effect, taxes would go up. A number of Americans would lose their jobs, those who are working for the government, those who are working for programs that are sponsored by the government. And there'd be more of this uncertainty, which is another sort of thing we keep hearing over and over again. Right. We just wouldn't know what was going to happen with the economy.
So what happens in the meantime? I mean, is this going to be a back and forth between Republicans and Democrats until the very last minute?
You know, you try to be optimistic about these things. I was driving into work the day after the election, and I sort of joked with someone when I got here that the city looked remarkably similar to the way it did the day before. Not a whole lot looked like it had changed. And I think that's true of the political climate here as well. There's some sense of optimism. But at this point, who knows? And they're due back here next week. They're due back here on Tuesday to start trying to hammer out some sort of deal. But they don't have a whole lot of time left, and we don't really know what's going to happen.
And does anybody really have any idea what the ramifications are if they don't deal with this by midnight on December 31st?
You know, plenty of people are speculating about that. I mean, people are saying that if the U.S. economy were to go over this cliff, it might lead to another recession. It could certainly hit the stock market pretty hard. People don't really know. There are some people even who are saying maybe it would be wisest for us to go over this cliff. If these tax rates were to go up, if these spending cuts were to take effect, that's going to actually lower the deficit. So maybe there is some logic to letting this happen.
Just for our listeners, any advice for them on how to prepare for this as it's happening? I mean, is there anything that we can do as individuals, or is it completely out of our hands?
It's kind of out of our hands. I'd say maybe pay attention to what's happening. I mean, obviously, what will affect us as Americans is what happens to these tax rates. And you think of December as this month when a lot of us are going out buying gifts. It's a month where we tend to spend a lot of money on things. Right.
And actually, we tend to do a lot of tax planning as well.
Absolutely. And if you're wondering, what's the size of my refund check going to be? Indeed, sort of, how am I going to be filing my taxes? That might cause you to say, you know what? I'm not going to spend as much as I used to, maybe. I might hold back. And that could be another effect on the economy. It could really lower the amount that we're spending on things.
I can't help but have this image of Thelma and Louise in my head every time I hear this stuff of the fiscal cliff. All right. David Gura joining us from Washington and Dan Gorenstein from our healthcare bureau in Philadelphia. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
So, of course, if you voted this year, the big ticket draw was the presidential election. But plenty of candidates and offices down ticket have even more of an influence on your personal finances. As Gretchen Kuda-Krohn reports, when it comes to the power of the purse, voters should be looking a little closer to home.
Last Tuesday, I stood outside Lincoln Elementary School in Lakewood, Ohio, and asked voters a simple question. Who do they think has more power over their financial bottom line, the president or locally elected officials.
Probably the president.
Lately, the president.
It's a trickle-down effect. So it's whoever's in the presidency is going to determine how the trickle-down effect happens overall through the states and then through the counties.
Voting local is clearly the place that's going to have the biggest impact on your bottom line.
Things like tax cuts and government spending were big presidential campaign issues. So it's no surprise that most people I talked to saw presidential policy as the key to restoring a healthy balance in their bank accounts. But for many of the things that really impact our day-to-day lives, it turns out that it's the candidates on the local ballot that really count. Sarah Elkind is a professor of political history at San Diego State University and the author of How Local Politics Shape Federal Policy.
Local government has an enormous impact on people's everyday lives and on the services that most people have the most contact with. So if you think about what government provides on a day-to-day basis, schools, transit, water supply, waste and sewage disposal, public health surveys of restaurants, fire, police, those things are mostly provided by local government. And if those services are not adequate, people have to supplement out of their own pocket.
Dale Miller was one of the candidates on the Lakewood ballot this year. A 20-year veteran of local politics, Miller was just reelected to the Cuyahoga County Council seat. Miller cites a laundry list of services county government runs and helps pay for.
We provide a broad array of human services, from adoption services to early childhood education. We help subsidize the county hospital, Metro, and senior and adult services, plus the public works, the roads and bridges and other infrastructure.
Also on Miller's to-do list, restore the $15 million budget shortfall, make county government more efficient, revitalize decaying urban neighborhoods, attract new businesses to the region, implement scholarship and job training programs, and grow the population by 100,000 people in the next decade.
I would be very surprised if we accomplished that, but anything in that direction would be a help.
By Miller's own admission, these are very ambitious goals. Cleveland and Cuyahoga County have a lot of serious economic problems. But then again, so does the country. So how does he think he'll do compared to the president?
The president and the Congress and their policies have the potential to affect the macro, large-scale direction of the economy. And that affects people's lives in a big way. I think local and county government is more likely to impact the quality of life, what the neighborhood looks like, and things of that nature.
Will those things impact your personal finances? That depends. It might not give you a bigger tax refund, but social programs and improvements to neighborhoods and roads could increase your property value, decrease crime, or save you money fixing your car. Professor Sarah Elkind says, more importantly, people need to realize that federal spending is shaped by an intimate relationship with local governments and the people who influence them.
Most of the government that matters in our daily lives and an awful lot of the federal spending and federal programs are happening because local communities want them.
And that's why voting for your city or county council person, someone like Dale Miller, is so important, because those officials have the power to shape the federal tax dollars that ultimately come back to you. In Cleveland, I'm Gretchen Kuda-Crowen for Marketplace.
You've probably heard the commercials on the radio, maybe not on this station, but somewhere, about wondrous loans that can help you out in a pinch. So-called payday loans are short-term loans backed by a post-dated personal check that borrowers agree to cover with money from their next paycheck. Those loans are typically for $100, $500, and they're usually to cover some kind of financial emergency. But that seemingly small amount of money can quickly spiral into out-of-control debt. Critics say the practice is ripe for abuse and should be tightly controlled, but commentator Tom Lehman says not so fast.
Payday lending has become common in the U.S., but it's attracted harsh criticism from many, and it's been banned or regulated out of existence in some states. But banning payday lending actually does more harm than good, by restricting credit options for those with no other recourse for loans. Critics object that fees for payday loans, typically $25 per transaction, are excessive. And sure, if you express that $25 as an annualized interest rate for a two-week $200 loan, the rate would be in the triple digits. But the fee is the risk premium the lender charges to provide loans to people who usually have poor credit. And borrowers don't look at the fee as an interest rate anyway. They recognize that $25 as much less than bank overdraft charges, late fees, and disconnect penalties from utilities. Critics also allege that payday loans trap borrowers in debt, sometimes taking months to repay and leading to a cascade of fees. While some payday borrowers do take longer to pay off their loans, this criticism confuses cause and effect. Belated repayment is almost always caused by unexpected financial emergencies, like surprise medical bills or car repairs. Borrowers pay additional fees to extend the payday loan until they can pay the balance, seeing an extension as the best alternative in those situations. Let's be clear. Those of us from outside the industry who defend the practice of payday lending are not apologists for payday lenders or for the choices made by their customers. We are instead defending the right of individuals to make voluntary choices in the marketplace, given their unique situation. The defenders of payday lending argue that financial resources are more productively employed when they are allocated by the voluntary forces of supply and demand. The critics of payday lending mostly reject market verdicts. The best way to help cash-constrained households during times of financial emergency is to give them as many choices as possible. You do not help marginal borrowers by laying out their available options and then eliminating by regulation the one they actually choose.
Tom Lehman is a professor of economics at Indiana Wesleyan University. No matter how you feel about payday lenders, there's no doubt they can land you in a whole lot of trouble if you don't understand how they work. Now, the same goes for all sorts of financial products, which is why it is so important to get educated. And if you want to start early, check out some of the new websites aimed at helping kids and parents manage their allowances. Dan Bobkoff introduces us to the Modern Piggy Bank.
This is how allowance works in the Skivara household. Each week, Suzanne and her husband dole out $7 to each of their two sons.
Can you check?
Shall we check if it says something? Okay, let's click on it.
Except, like a lot of money these days, this isn't cash. It shows up as a number on a computer screen.
What happened here? I see you lost $10 down here.
What?
Look, $10.
In their house near San Francisco, Suzanne and her 8-year-old Michael are looking at a site called FamZoo on her laptop. It shows how much of his allowance he saved and spent, and no transaction goes unrecorded.
Lost bet with Tom, your big brother.
What was that bet?
About a video game to see. We were betting what name it was.
Hey, sometimes it's a learning experience. These sites are kind of like online banking for kids, complete with graphs and charts. Suzanne Skivara had longed for something like this. She and her husband wanted to instill some financial responsibility in their kids, in part to make up for the mistakes of her younger years when she spent her entire paycheck each month.
Nobody had ever told me or sat me down and said, okay, this is what you need to do. I want you to put this amount in your savings and you should be thinking about this for the future.
Some of these sites are designed to teach lessons about saving and charity. Michael, the 8-year-old, deposits $1.75 into four categories in his virtual bank account.
Yeah, I have a quarter for college savings, a quarter for money for the poor.
And if you think that's responsible, Michael's older brother is even saving for a house. He's 10. So each son can see exactly how much he saved. And when one wants something, say a soda at a restaurant or the latest video game,
put the chip in here.
Suzanne and her husband can pull up the FamZoo app on their phones and show him his balance in his account. He then has to decide whether to spend or save. The parents benefit too, never forgetting to give an allowance. But because these accounts are virtual, Suzanne says she has to make sure she has real money to back the allowance savings.
And so once those numbers start getting bigger, you have to be prepared for them asking you for the $600 for something.
It can get up to $600 because to encourage savings, Suzanne Skivara pays her kids a stellar 5% interest rate per month. But so far, the Skivaras are mostly the exception. Despite the slew of startups offering allowance tracking, Stessa Cohen of technology research firm Gartner says they remain niche.
First of all, what's the business model for it? Okay. But potentially, it's a set of capabilities that banks could incorporate into their product offerings, both existing and new.
For now, these standalone sites rely on subscriptions, advertising, or tie-ins with online stores. But Cohen expects these sites to take off once they're tied to real banks. One day you might see your kid's allowance as a direct debit from your account. But Beth Kobliner is skeptical about this digitizing of the allowance. She's the author of Get a Financial Life, and she says if you want to teach kids about money, use cash.
I think there is a benefit for children seeing that, or seeing maybe a parent run out of enough cash one day to realize, oh, I need more cash and I can't buy everything I want just because I have a piece of plastic. I have to really make sure I have the money to pay for it.
And Kobliner worries some of these sites, which are connected with online stores, could lead kids to spend more and save less. But Stessa Cohen of Gartner sees the utility of the virtual bank account. Besides researching the industry for Gartner, she's realizing it could help in her family. Her son, Eris, says his mom is a bit behind on his allowance.
Yeah, by about 1 year.
He better hope she pays interest. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Okay, raise your hand if you like going to the doctor's office. Right, thought so. Not the most comfortable place to spend your time. You're sick, you're worried about what's wrong, and you're probably covered up by what amounts to a few pieces of toilet paper. Most of us just want to get out of there as fast as possible. But when the news isn't good, there are tough choices to be made about treatment and the cost of your options. Peter Ubel says better communication can save you money on your medical bills if you ask the right questions. He's a physician and behavioral scientist at Duke University, also the author of Critical Decisions, How You and Your Doctor Can Make the Right Medical Choices Together. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Why is it so difficult for us to talk with our doctors about everything from diagnosis to treatment?
Oh, imagine yourself half naked on an exam room table. A person with a stethoscope has just given you maybe bad news. You're scared. You're confused. And now you're supposed to be an equal partner in the decisions? That's
right.
Not easy to do.
And when the idea of money comes into that equation, it's even harder because there you are, as you said, half naked. Perhaps you've gotten some bad news and you've got to make a decision. And on top of that, you got to figure out, you know, what's best for your wallet.
Oh, and I often think that's not at all what's on people's minds because you're thinking about your health. And then you, even if money does come up, I bet most people are wondering, is it even appropriate for me to mention that?
And is it?
Oh, it's absolutely appropriate. The right medical, say, treatment depends on the pros and cons of your alternatives. And one of those is how much it costs. And there are people with cancer diagnoses right now undergoing treatment who are experiencing not only side effects from their medication, but financial toxicity from their medication. It's so hard to pay for the medicines, they're having to decide what corners to cut in the rest of their lives.
But I think what always goes through your head is, you know what, when we're talking about my life, money should not be an object.
But money is part of our lives, as your show has demonstrated many times. Yeah. And often there are alternatives out there, and you need to know what those alternatives are. Maybe there is no other good alternative, and you're going to have to decide to find a way to find the money. But I think your best bet is to first find out what your alternatives are. If you don't have to leap into a decision, just say, well, what are my other alternatives, just so I know. And then try to just get a general sense. Is the alternative a generic? Yeah, it's a pretty good bet that's going to be a lot less expensive than a trade drug. If the alternative is watchful waiting rather than plunging into an aggressive treatment, that's almost certainly going to be a lot less expensive.
That's really kind of, I think, a shift in thinking when you're in there with the doctor who has multiple degrees, has a nice white coat on, and I think there's just a lot of deference given to them. And it's very hard to say, well, can you give me some other options even though you think this is best?
I'll tell you, when a patient comes up to me and says, I'm struggling, look how expensive this medicine is, I'm grateful to them. I know more about what's going on in their lives than I knew 2 minutes ago. I'll start realizing that there were alternatives I hadn't considered. And so that's a favor to your doctor to communicate. We can't read our patients' minds, so you have to tell us what you're thinking and feeling.
What's the most effective way to advocate for yourself? You know, it sounds really easy, just talk to your doctor, but for some reason, that's not easy for us.
It really is hard. It's hard to talk about money in all kinds of aspects of our lives. When our own health is at risk and we're trying to remain a trusting relationship with our doctor, that's even harder. I think just remember, you deserve time. And your doctor may send signals that she's rushed and ready to get on to the next patient, but you deserve your doctor's time. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Bring someone to your appointments when you have important decisions to make. Maybe somebody who's willing to step in is a little less shy than you are, someone at a minimum who can take notes, but maybe someone who can act as your advocate.
And that's particularly important, I can say from experience, when you're dealing with bad news, because you're going to leave that room and not remember anything that was said.
Oh, yeah. I think once someone gives you that bad news, they tell you, say, that you have cancer, the rest of the conversation is blah, 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 cancer. So I think you don't even have to have it doesn't have to be a close friend or a loved one that comes in with you. Sometimes a more objective person, someone you just trust and respect, can come in. There are programs in the country, and they're starting to become more common, where they're just having decision coaches sit in the rooms with patients when they meet with their doctors.
A decision coach? Huh.
Yeah. Find out if your healthcare, if your hospital or the healthcare clinic you go to have decision coaches. If they don't, tell them if they want to keep you there as a customer for a long period of time. They should start getting a program.
Dr. Peter Ubel is a physician, a behavioral scientist, and bioethicist at Duke University. He's also the author of Critical Decisions, How You and Your Doctor Can Make the Right Medical Choices Together. Together being the operative word here. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
On Veterans Day this week, we honor our soldiers and the sacrifices they've made, the wounds, mental and physical, that they've endured. Many veterans come back from years in Iraq or Afghanistan only to fight an uphill battle readjusting to a civilian world. Today's vets face further troubles with debt, unemployment, even foreclosure. But in Arizona, a special state government fund turns donations into emergency financial help for those former soldiers. The Public Insight Network's Jeff Severns Gunzel reports.
Applicant is a Ranger medic, received the Bronze Star with the V device.
Once a month, the board members of Arizona's Military Family Relief Fund gather around a long conference table. They've raised more than $1 million in the past year, and now they're looking over applications for their emergency grants.
Issues is requesting assistance for up to 6 months of rent and auto insurance.
Only a handful of states offer this kind of relief to veterans. The application in front of the board now is from a 28-year-old veteran who left the military last year to pursue a degree in microbiology.
My name is Eric Batori, and I was a Ranger medic for 2 Iraq deployments and a deployment to Afghanistan.
Batori is asking for help with rent and car insurance. He's waiting on a severely backlogged Veterans Administration to process his disability claim. He's been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. During his 2 tours in Iraq, he rode on hundreds of dangerous missions as a platoon medic. In his downtime, he volunteered at a combat trauma hospital. He traces his PTSD to his first weeks in Iraq, but it was Afghanistan that sent him spinning.
Our first mission, I was in a helicopter that got shot down. They kept us there for another 4 months. So I was sweating every time I got on a helicopter. You know, I started to shake anytime it moved, or, you know, we felt any turbulence that wasn't expected. So it really kind of shook my foundation. And about 9 months later, I ended up deciding to get out. I realized that I had, a problem that I think was beyond my ability to just kind of smother it or deal with it on my own.
A monthly disability check will allow him to focus more on his studies and less on scraping by. But there are more than 800,000 unresolved claims in the VA's national backlog. And in Phoenix, it takes close to a year on average to process a claim. And there is still a stigma around PTSD. Battori himself sometimes doubted if he even deserved disability pay, despite his Bronze Star and constant exposure to combat trauma. The claims process did not reassure him.
I felt like the VA process was kind of punitive. They, you know, regularly tell you if you miss this, then you're dropped from the system. You know, if you have trouble with maintaining appointments, they don't take that into account. I felt like they were treating me like with skepticism or, you know, kind of a why now attitude, even with records.
You know, you're a young guy, you're in the military, just about everybody outranks you. And it's very intimidating to, you know, dig into the system and make it work the way it should.
That's Randy Meyer, the Arizona Relief Fund chairman. He works hard to keep his application process as simple and supportive as possible, especially for vulnerable young veterans like Battori.
I receive VA disability, so I've lived that process. We have the success that we have in our program because people are comfortable coming to us for help. All those in favor of approving 3 months' request at 252198, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Battori will be getting his emergency grant, 3 months of rent and car insurance paid directly to the landlord and the insurance company. And after more than a year of waiting on the VA to process his disability claim, he's been approved. For Battori, the grant will be a lifeline until the disability checks start coming.
It's going to allow me to be able to kind of focus on moving forward. You know, because the main focus right now with my treatment is to move on and to kind of develop the other side of myself.
More than 500,000 veterans are already receiving disability checks for PTSD. Many of them served in Iraq and Afghanistan. The VA is expecting more than 1 million new disability claims in the coming year and told me that it's deploying new, more efficient technology for handling claims. But that process, too, has been slow. Support services like Arizona's Military Family Relief Fund will be critical for years to come. Lately, the fund has been getting calls from veterans advocates in other states interested in offering emergency grants to their veterans. In Phoenix, I'm Jeff Severns Gunsel for Marketplace.
We just heard about a program for veterans in Arizona, and now a different kind of assistance at the other end of the country. We've all heard the stories about the tough times some service members are having finding a job when they return from war. The unemployment rate for veterans is 6.3%. For disabled servicemen and women, that number jumps to 8.5%. But some vets are looking to unconventional ways to make a living, at least unconventional for a warrior. Alex Blair reports from a small farm in North Carolina.
Alex Sutton joined the Army straight out of high school.
I was 17 years old and I joined the military.
Over the next 13 years, he served multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan as a sniper. Then in 2007, his legs were blown off by a roadside bomb. Now he walks on titanium legs and takes more than 15 medications for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Alex is a decorated and disabled veteran.
Good morning, USA.
He's also a farmer.
This is my lovely wife-to-be, Jessica Silberhorn. We are the proud owners and operators of Sutton Heritage Farms.
Alex may not have his own legs, but he is still strong, tall, and broad. Alex and Jessica live in the small town of Jackson Springs, North Carolina.
It was pretty much love at first sight.
Jessica says they met when he answered her call on Craigslist, looking for someone to go fishing with.
After a while, about 6 months of dating, we decided that we probably wanted to spend the rest of our lives together.
They bought a home for themselves and their animals. Dozens of birds wander around the front yard. You have to step carefully around them and keep an eye out for the odd, angry goose. Their farm specialty is heritage poultry, chickens with strange names.
We have Barred Rocks, Delawares, Dominiquers, Gold Campines.
They also have quails and ducks and turkeys. They have pigs and goats and horses and dogs. They also grow a bit of corn and soybeans. For now, they just sell the eggs and birds out of their home. It's nothing like his old job in the Army. After all, Alex was a sniper. He spent days at a time traveling through deserted roads and villages, constantly aware of his soldiers, constantly scouting for danger, and often killing the enemy.
I mean, that's all I did was kill. There was nothing else to it. There was no taking prisoners. There was no taking hostages. It was just death and destruction. And it bothered me. It did. It really did. But I never let it because it was mission. I didn't have time to feel sad. I didn't have time to feel remorse.
But of course, after the army, Alex did have time to feel and to think about what came next, how to fill the rest of his life.
I spent 13 years killing people. What am I supposed to do in the civilian world?
He ended up going back to what he knew.
I'm a country boy.
Like Alex, almost half of returning soldiers come from America's rural areas. But most vets don't transition into being farmers or are even lucky enough to find meaningful work. Alex receives a disability check in the mail each month from the Army for $2,000. He also receives a retirement check and a few other benefits. All in all, it comes to about $4,000 a month. He says there's no way the farm would be where it is without the help of others. One of those others is Michael O'Gorman. O'Gorman is the founder of the Farmer Veteran Coalition.
The veterans, the challenge that they face is the same challenge that all beginning farmers face. And they need a lot of support, and we need to invest in them.
To make that investment, O'Gorman proposed a beginning farmer microloan program to the USDA. The loans would range from $5,000 to $30,000. Right now, beginning farmers can take out loans in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to get up and running. O'Gorman says new farmers need to be really careful about taking out crazy amounts of money.
They're going through life-changing transitions. They're starting families, getting married, they're having kids, they're paying bills. That's a lot of indebtedness.
O'Gorman says farming and soldiering have a lot in common. They're both outdoor physical jobs, but O'Gorman says farming offers something else that resonates with veterans.
People talk about farming, how healing that must be. The real secret to the healing is that they're needed.
That's true for Alex. He says that his animals are like his soldiers. He feels responsible for their lives.
I just want to be able to give back. You know, for my whole life, since I was 17, I've been in the military, and all I've been doing is serving my country. And just because I'm hurt doesn't mean I want to stop doing that. It's just I have to figure out a different way to do it.
When I've spent time with Alex, he'll work himself too hard, to the point of limping and then collapsing. His legs can no longer hold up his body. When he talks about his war experience in detail, he can shut down for days. He doesn't like to call up memories of life as a sniper and how good he was at his job. Perhaps he'll carry his PTSD for the rest of his life. Even so, Alex's story is one of possibility, that those who have lived through the worst and most awful parts of war don't have to feel like there's nothing else left for them.
You know, pain is temporary, pride is forever. Of course it hurts, and it hurts my body every friggin' day that I push it out here. But you know what? It's that pride. It's worth it all just to see that one little sprout come out of the ground, or to see that one little baby chip its way out of the shell. You know, it's worth every ounce of pain.
More than anything, Alex would like to reach out to other soldiers to show them that farming is just another way to serve your country. In Jackson Springs, North Carolina, I'm Alex Blair for Marketplace.
When it comes to cutting the household budget, the cable TV subscription is kind of a tough one to let go of. It's not that we want to have a service that provides us with more channels than we could possibly ever watch, but we usually don't have a choice. You buy one channel, you buy all 1,800. There has been some discussion, even in Congress, about changing that system to something more like an a la carte menu. You buy only what you want to watch. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine, and he writes in this month's issue that this could be the wave of the TV future, but that won't necessarily help your bank account. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Talk to us about this notion of offering viewers the option of paying per program. So you basically start programming your television by yourself, right?
This is the dream, right? This is the dream of people who are cutting the cord, and really of all of us. Who wouldn't love an iTunes of video? The
right.
Second that a show becomes live, you just pay $1.29 or maybe $3 or $5 for that show. Whatever it is, you watch it whenever you want. You don't have to pay for ABC Family or MTV2. That would be lovely. The problem is that when you do the back of the envelope math, it becomes very clear very quickly that TV on demand would probably be either much more expensive than we think or much lower quality than we'd accept. It'd be much more expensive than we think because one of the ways that all these networks make money is that magically through the bundle, the millions of households that don't watch particular networks are still paying for those particular networks.
Right.
And so even though television is this expensive and risky business where most of the shows that are made, most of the pilots that are made don't last 6 months, they're still protected by this steady stream of revenue that can sort of offset the risk. Because media companies essentially have been dictating their terms to cable companies and saying, if you want to buy ESPN, say I'm Disney, if you want to buy ESPN, you have to buy everything that I have to offer. And that's why we get stuck with this cable bundle that goes up to 301,000 channels.
But wasn't that the argument that was espoused by the music industry as well when iTunes came along? That, well, if we're not able to sell people whole albums, whole CDs, then we're not going to be able to take those same risks.
Sure. Think about a song. It's fairly easy to download as a bit. It's very small. But imagine what it would take to stream high-quality live video for, say, a sports event. It's extremely difficult. So downloading Taylor Swift and watching the World Series live, it's very different in terms of the pure technology of it. The second thing, though, is pure chronology. The people who own video content today are looking back and seeing that music got crushed by the internet. They're much less likely to look at a company like Apple and say, oh, sure, we'll give you a sweetheart deal for all of our content because you're such a great company and you make such beautiful, sleek screens. Heck no. They're thinking, we know what happened when you did this to the music industry, and their total industry revenue plummeted by 50% in 10 years. There is no way that we're going to do that to our extremely valuable line of products. We're going to demand that you pay exactly what Comcast and Time Warner Cable are paying. We're not going to let you cut and splice everything up and ruin our bundle. The internet, ironically, is less likely to disrupt video the same way that it's done for newspapers or for music. We still have the same number of paid TV customers now that we did 5 years ago. During a recession, it doesn't seem like doom times just yet for cable, but that doesn't mean it won't in 5 or 10 years.
Well, so what could this potentially mean to consumers in terms of their bill? I mean, if you move away from a bundled cable package, how much could each of those channels then cost? I mean, is it possible to say at this point?
Well, right now, so every single time you pay, let's say, $80 a month to Time Warner Cable, ESPN gets $5 of that. So, you know, I sort of calculated that if you wanted to buy ESPN alone, you might have to pay $10 or even $20 just to get ESPN every single month.
Whoa.
To offset the lost advertising.
That's just one channel. So it's almost like the health insurance model where you have to have all the healthy people in there at the same time as you have all the sick people so that everybody has to pay into the system.
I think thinking of this as an insurance program is actually extremely apt, right? This is revenue insurance.
Right.
This is the media company's way of making sure that every single time a family that pays for television turns on their TV, they have a shot of watching your network against which they are selling advertising. Demand is a strong force here. But one element that I think is overlooked is the fact that cable is sort of, kinda, a really good deal.
Yeah. Based on how you've described it, it certainly sounds like that.
Right. Let's think about the cable bundle. It's $80 a month, let's say.
Yeah.
For a family of three or four that watches on average, and this is from Nielsen, 3 to 4 to 5 hours of television a day. And those are the real numbers. If you multiply that out, you get TV costing about 20 to 30 cents per person per hour.
Huh.
Think about how that compares to other pieces of entertainment. A concert that costs $100 is $50 per hour. A movie that costs $12 is about $6 or $4 an hour. Yeah. And one thing that we calculated that's sort of funny, if you bought a football game for Xbox, you bought it in September on the first day of the NFL season, you would have to play it every day of the calendar year into 2013 until the Super Bowl for 2 hours a day in order to get the same per hour, per person value as cable.
Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he oversees business coverage for TheAtlantic.com. You can find his article on the future of television in this month's issue. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. This was fun.
So what's on your mind when it comes to money? We want to know what you're thinking and talking about when it comes to your personal finances, and we'd like to help. So write to us and tell us what's on your mind. You can reach us on Facebook, via Twitter, and, of course, by writing to us at marketplace.org. Now, if you'll indulge me for a moment or two, I'd like to share a few personal observations. This is my penultimate hour of Marketplace Money. As we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I'm leaving after 6 years hosting this show, 11 years at Marketplace. Next week is our special partnership with the New York Times, so this is kind of my last chance to say a few other words before goodbye. I have to tell you, I never imagined I'd host a show about personal finance for a couple of reasons. First, I've always been terrible with money. And second, I've always been terrible with money. Astute listeners will have already picked up on that. I learned a lot just by hosting this show, though. 6 years of daily immersion in one subject. Well, I should be making better choices just by osmosis. And I do, not always, but certainly more than I used to. And I learned a lot about money from you. Many of you are way smarter about it than I am. And I can see that in the emails that you send in after hearing our call-in segments. Sometimes I wish that we had you on the line to help that other listener. But unfortunately, most of our mail is the opposite. So many of you are in pain because of money. You're baffled by it. You're afraid of it. And you don't want anyone to know, because God forbid we talk openly about our money issues. Now, here's where I could insert a bunch of the usual personal finance bromides. Spend less than you earn, save all you can for retirement, stick to a budget. Sure, all those are important, but after 6 years of dispensing financial advice, or at least being in the room when we gave that advice, it really comes down to one thing: choices. And there's almost nothing more personal in our lives than the choices we make. So no radio show, no blog, no book is going to be able to do that for you. And the system today demands so many more financial choices from all of us. We have to manage our own retirement accounts. We have to save enormous sums for college. We pay a far bigger chunk of our own health care bills. We're really on our own, and we're terrified we're not going to have enough. So we take risks with our money that we probably shouldn't. So if you need help, find an advisor and pay for an hour or two of help. Or try out Dave or Sue's if you like. Or start with some tutorials on the government's Consumer Financial Protection website. The resources really are endless. So do as much as you can to educate yourself. And then give yourself a break. If you look back at your financial life so far, you probably did a few things you wish you hadn't. Welcome to my world. But we got through it, right? Or we're working to get there. So give yourself a break. And while you're at it, why don't you give everybody else a break too? Lots of people made lots of mistakes over the last few years with their mortgages, with overspending, with trying to time the stock market. But that doesn't mean that they deserve a lesser life when they wake up to the consequences of those choices. Maybe, just maybe, it's on all of us to have a little more compassion for the mistakes and the struggle. It has been an honor. It has been my privilege. And I will miss all of you more than you could possibly ever know. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. As I mentioned, I'm not done just yet. Next week, our special collaboration with the New York Times about bulletproofing your finances against a possible crisis, including when a tornado takes your house and everything in it.
I don't think through this whole thing that I've ever really worried about the financial part of it that much.
I don't think you can ever completely prepare financially, which doesn't mean you shouldn't be prepared, because we did what we could do.
You can read the coverage in Wednesday's Times and then join us to listen to it next weekend. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Mary Dew. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week. This is APM.